Welcome to Starfleet Universe On Call. I am Paul France, owner of France Games. I'm an SFB Online, FedCom Online, and Starfleet Warlord. Just a reminder, join us with a podcast every Thursday starting at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. You can either call on the phone just off 605-562-0444, just follow the directions of call IDs 17702. Or you can participate on the web. Just go to twitch.tv/SFUOnCall. That's the best place to find us. And you'll have a live feed there. And so that'd be great for you. And you can participate in the chat room. Also, if you want to find me on, of course, TalkShoe.com, which is where who's supporting this. To a certain degree, that's where I host some of my podcasts, and that's where they help me with the phone part of it. And that's going to be TalkShoe.com to search for call ID 17702. Or search for Starfleet Universe On Call, and you'll find me there. You can look at the past episodes. You can listen to me live if you want to. Chat room, not so great. Most of the people that were there have migrated over to Twitch by this time. Also, if you need to contact me for any reason, my email address is sfuoncall@gmail.com. It's sfuoncall@gmail.com. Also, you want to follow me on Twitter. My podcast account there is also SFU On Call. Also, if you want to follow me on my personal account, that's Paul Franz. It's PAUFRANZ. There's no T in that. And just a reminder, I am an ardent Catholic and a rabid O's fan, and I love all kinds of tech. Anything that bothers you, like if you're a Yankees fan and don't like the O's, then don't follow me. And of course, I have my business account, which is Franz Games. So FRANZGMES. And you'll find news there and also client updates. And of course, this lovely TalkCast gets turned into a podcast available on iTunes and various other feeds around the net. Some quick news from ADB, just a note that they had a little problem with their server as of late, that was 6 days ago, because of Ian, and the servers at where? Florida! I think it's time to move to a little more drier place, I think. Right now, they're just having a little problem with email glitching on and on, so hopefully they'll switch that to a better email provider. I think that'd be a better thing for them to do. And of course, some quick news, Federation and Empire, that's F&E, Advanced Operations is currently in Gene's hands. So we have progress for that, for Advanced Operations. She's got it with the Purple Pen of Death. Well, not Purple Pen of Death, but she'll be marking it up. I don't think she calls it the Purple Pen of Death, but it's the Purple Pen. Because she prints it out, and then, you know, being the editor she is, she marks it all up. So hopefully that'll be out soon. And of course, just a reminder that ADB has all kinds of free stuff. Just go to starfleetgames.com, go to the Master Index, and you'll find all kinds of things you can download, from desktop images to errata to updates to I think First Missions is also there. Or you can find First Missions, which is for a Federation Commander that, you know, to teach you the system, things like that. And I think you will be interested to see that. Well, moving on to the SFB Online Tournament, Sapphire Star 12 Tournament is still looking for, I think it's 4 more individuals. They're up to 12. So if you're still interested, sign up, pay your $10, and let's get going. And of course, when it comes to the actually library report, we actually have some updates, some fixes for the SFB library. Some of the Lyrans, actually, that reminds me, I got IM'd on Discord by Frank that he has fixed the Hellbore base, so I need to update that in the actual library. Also, many Lyrans ships have not been, they're fixed, but I have not posted them yet just because of there's an ongoing game. And then lastly, and not leastly, there were like Paravians and Carnivans And some, I forget what other, there's another Empire that was got updated, but there have been multiple updates, so that's always good to see. So with that, that is the news for this week. And it's me, it's the only Paul France welcoming you to Star for the Universe On Call. And tonight, well, we got me, of course me, and we have Doug. How you doing, Doug?
Hey, I'm here. How's it going?
Going good, going good. What the heck was
that? Getting over the cold thing, so laugh, hack, wheeze, etc.
Okay, someone else just dialed in. I'll let him enter and just see what happens there. That might be Jeff, for all I know. But anyhow, let's see if this is Jeff. Jeff, is that you?
Hi, can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Yay, okay, so to heck with the mobile interface, we'll go with the phone interface.
That seems to be working quite well.
Life of a trucker.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Yeah, I did get, just to let you know, I did get your email. I've not had a chance to check it out. I'm not sure if you're the person who...
No worries.
...who pinged me before about
I was under
issues.
The impression it was probably a talk shoe problem anyway.
It is possible. I had to... Last time that I ran into the same issue, I had to play around with it some because there's some episodes that were missing. Yeah, the person said that there were episodes that were missing. Not that the feed didn't work. For you, the feed's not working, right?
Well, it comes back as an invalid link. One of the issues I've heard about with other podcasts is that RSS feeds are limited to the allowable size of an XML file. And if you've exceeded that size, then you run into Stack Overflow issues. It could also be why the RSS feed just displays a blank line of text.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
No.
Rocket History Podcast ran into that issue, and so he ended up splitting off all of his old episodes into an archive screen.
Oh, yeah. Understood. Yeah. I've heard of the issue where if you have more than, I think it's 50 episodes, some podcasts. Apps kind of fail or get squirrely. Now, the reason why I'm laughing, Jeff, is that you said like there becomes some issue with the Stack Overflow. It's like, excuse me, one, I'm a developer. So I know what a Stack Overflow is. If you are getting a Stack Overflow issue with a podcast whose feed is too long, you've got a problem, my dear friend. You've got a real issue. Because, one...
Well, you know, when I was growing up, they said air is human, but to really foul things up requires a computer.
Amen.
That's changed.
No, it's still the same. Learners, it's not easy to foul things up with a computer in larger amounts. It's... That should not occur. A Stack Overflow, no. Now, if I can see an issue where I can see a podcast app that if a podcast feed gets too long for the actual feed, then what might happen is that it takes too long to load, and which because it might go and check each and every episode, make sure it's valid and so forth, instead of only downloading.
I got you.
The episodes that you asked to be downloaded from.
Feed link. When I click the RSS feed link, all I get is the flat file XML readout. It doesn't do anything else. It just shows me the XML.
Okay. Well, what phone are you doing this on your phone?
Usually, because I don't have regular access to a desktop.
Okay. What kind of phone?
It's iPhone 12 Pro.
Okay. Then
doing it in Safari, that's why I was trying to get the iTunes link to work, because that's the format designed for my hardware.
What you probably should do is go into the podcast app and search for Starfleet Universe on Call. That's probably the best way of doing it. And if it doesn't,
and I did that, and it got zero results, which is why I kept trying to back channel it.
Okay, hold on. That should still be listed. Let me go check. Don't mind me. I am bringing up my phone right now. My iPhone 12.
I mean, I was born blind, so it's entirely possible I typoed the search terms.
Starfleet Universe on Call. There it is. I really should fix that. The name is The Andromedan, which is true. I'm looking, and it's got the latest episode, episode 682, Starfleet Universe on Call. And, yep, short description is Doug and I discuss F&E Android Wars.
Okay, there you are.
So.
And now you're at it.
Yep, and I'm looking, and.
Speaking of Android Wars, if you ever get around to old business, I have an idea for you about the last podcast when you were talking about trying to set the RTN up for F&E.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure Doug would love to discuss that with us.
Yeah. So just let me know when to hit you with it.
Hit now. Let's start now.
Yes, all right. Borrow a page from Cassione. 2.5-3 inch double-sided laminated hex counters. On the one side, you write the RTN note number, and on the inverse, you write the details of it, exactly where hex it is. If you move it, wipe it off, write the new hex, flip it back over. People can figure out where the individual nodes are and can move them. You can even put space on the front of it so they can figure out, okay, this RTN node's in Klingon space, and it's in this region, and it's in this sector, and it's on this hex, as you get further refined intelligence, in which case the Andromeda player goes, no, it's not, I moved it. And you can turn around and flip it over to show everybody that it's not there, or show everybody that it is.
Right.
It's double blind using pencil and paper.
Mm-hmm.
And since you have to build the RTN nodes, which is my guess, you would add a new hex counter every time you got a new node. And then that way you could backtrack through as you roll out over the playfield.
Right. Quote unquote build. Yeah, it'd be like a starbase. You know, starbases, they bring
it'd
the
pieces. It'd be exactly like a starbase.
Right. They bring all the pieces together and then they build it on site, yeah.
My guess is that you would start with a number of node slots and you'd have to purchase an extra node slot if you wanted to extend the network, and then you could move the individual nodes within the rules for moving such things. I just thought that the double-sided laminated counters would be a good way to track it on the table.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Doug?
Sure.
Stop.
That's one. That sounds good. My question is, how many different places are they going to have?
You mean how many nodes?
You have a huge map. You have all the different empires. How many outlets are you going to have? How many ways do they have to deal with it? And one thing that I was thinking, that I was heavily leaning towards in just thinking about how to do it would be, that's a good idea. I mean,
well, the idea I was thinking was you'd have one set of rules for moving the nodes. We know they can be moved. That's part of why it took so hard to chase them down. The first node, the link node, the anchor node, would always be in the LNC. That's the Achilles heel. That's the weakness. That's the weak spot.
Right.
But as they build additional nodes into the black, into the alpha octet, they get additional rapid transit lines between their various nodes, which is why I suggested the hex based counters, because then you could build them out like the transit network. But as far as how many you get, how many you start with, what they cost to build, and everything else, that's going to be the devil in the detail.
True. That's one of the things that's kind of to be worked out through playtest, and obviously first guessing and then playtesting it out and see what works best. You know, obviously it's not, now, like anything else, expanding the game, especially when it comes to Andromedans, in my mind, because of how things work is so different. Even at the strategic level, with the RTN nodes and so forth, where the whole idea is at the RTN, the Rapid Transit, the network, that network itself is unknown, and no one sees it. You know, you have these ships going from point A to point B, and they don't see the ships. Which always makes it interesting.
From my limited understanding of it, and granted, I'm working off knowledge that's 20 plus years old.
Mm-hmm.
The RTN is a third tier transportation network. Warp drive is a second tier transportation network. Interstellar space is a first tier transportation network, and atmospherics would be a zero tier transportation network. If you're inside an atmosphere, you probably can't see things moving at warp speed. So it's not unreasonable that you couldn't see anything moving at the RTN.
Right.
And my guess is that each individual disruptor device equipped mothership has a sphere, probably on the order of a couple of parsecs, that they can jump from their current place with non-combat movement to the RTN node and then interface the RTN and then go longer distances. And that allows them to put the node nowhere near where they set up the Starbase. And that's probably another reason why it took so long for the Galactic Powers to figure out how to follow it back.
Yeah, but the whole thing with the nodes themselves, which were usually they were bases themselves, where the nodes were bases. That's why you had to come with a one something like a galactic survey cruiser, which had armaments that could actually destroy the base. You know, and you have to do that before they could actually get enough resources there to defend it, you know, or have it so that it kind of disappears. But
it would be interesting to sit down with the Steves and find out what their intents are on those things, to be honest. And we can speculate till we're blue in the face, but as Doug has said last week and even tonight, and as you're pointing out, when it comes down to it, the thing is that we're just spitballing here.
No, agreed.
The thing is that Starfleet Battles, the game engine that generated all of this, doesn't deal with strategic level movement all that well at all. It was never designed to.
Right.
And the RTN is a strategic level system. Well, we get into F&E, and for one reason or another, we never had the F&E rules for the Andromeda invasion. This is probably one of the reasons. Hmm. I don't know if there's playtests on it from years back or not, but the thing is that when you've got a cluster of rules that are very congruent, the last thing you want to do is throw a spanner in the works, which is why the Steves are very resistant to certain types of proposals. I think I can be kind and say it that way.
Agreed. And as I think, and definitely Steve Cole has said himself, which is he's not really looking for proposals because he's got his own ideas on how things will work. And Lord knows, he's a game designer. Let's be honest here. We are not game designers. We've never designed, produced, and sold a game. So, for the most part,
it's his baby. He's put 40-plus years of his life into it. I mean, it's his bailiwick.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that plus, yeah. And just from a significant chunk of that time of watching the process, like, yeah, there's reasons why there's a lot of resistance to, say, the outside. And there are good reasons. Some of them are not, but there's that. So, I'm sorry, go on.
I missed the object of your comment. The resist to what?
Outside input. So.
Outside input, right.
Yeah.
And
there's a lot of people that will see. Yeah, there's a lot of people that see the terms and conditions for posting on the Discord, or the not the Discord, but the Discus bulletin board.
Discuss, yeah.
As well as discussion, yeah, the discussion bulletin board, the official one, as well as the various terms and conditions, along with providing unsolicited proposals and everything else, and it's because he's been around the block long enough to know what happens when you have somebody show up and go, hey, I sent you that 20 years ago. You told me I was full of stuff. You didn't want to use my stuff, and now you're making millions on it? Because that happened to Marvel in the 90s on stuff they talked about in the early days of Marvel. I mean, it happens a lot in certain segments, and it's just the way it is. So you gotta protect yourself, and let's face it, we wouldn't have this great game to play and talk about if they spent all their money in courts and paying lawyers, now would they?
Agreed.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I'm just hopeful that they've got a burn bag with the stuff I sent in the 90s. Because I'm not sure I ever want some of that stuff to see the light of day.
Yep, I'm sure you don't. But to me, there's always that great sadness when I think about all the ideas that Bruce Grawl came up for the Omega Octant and those empires and those being lost in the great hard drive crash, you know?
Yeah,
which was awful because you know I thought he had the ideas, he just didn't. But everything they wrote down is gone. Zone. Yeah,
I got this huge dioptic zone. I found the game in '92. I joined in '94, and I really enjoyed the interplay when the official discussion board was on Genie. When that service concluded, I was still playing with a local group out of Little Rock, and we broke up around 98 or 99. And things just quieted down, and my interests went in other directions because, let's face it, when you're the last holdout and everybody else has moved on to the latest and greatest system, I think it was Bad Five Wars at the time, it gets kind of hard to do anything on a Saturday night. I do remember finally when Starfleet Command came out. I was thrilled that it was based on the engine I understood.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it was only recently that I got back into it. So I've got all this 20 years or so to catch up on. And things like the Bruce Raw and his hard drive crash. It's just one of those things. I've got to find the details on one of these places. I keep wanting to go grab a whole bunch of captain's logs and just read up on the news. I guess that's the only way to really do it at this point.
Yep, agreed. Well, the Captain's Logs give you a great source of fiction and playtest rules, you know, for those things like the FedCom X-ships, FedCom fighters, and the gunships for FedCom, which is really interesting. I can't wait for them to actually put out one of those things. Now, as I talked about, you know, before, and probably this a few months ago, I personally would like to see FedCom X-ships come out ASAP. That's the first thing I'd like to see come out, which I think would be fantastic.
When I dropped out the most recent Captain's Log was 17. That was the last Captain's Log published by Task Force Games. And it was also the last Captain's Log published for like 2.5 years or so, if you look at the text on the Captain's Log 18 page right. on their web store, mm-hmm. on the Amarillo web store.
Right.
And that, it made my whole gaming group think that when Task Force Games kind of dissolved, that the Starfleet Battles went with it.
Huh, that's interesting.
And that was, like I said, recently when I discovered that it was, one, still around, and two, making new stuff, it was, like, really interesting. So all of a sudden I picked up a copy of Federation Commander, and I'm scratching my head going, this is really lightweight. This is, I can't believe how many rules this isn't.
Well,
you look at the master rulebook for Federation Commander, and it's about the size of the spiral bound notebook you had in school for one class for one subject.
Right, right.
You know, you grab the master rulebook, the printed master rulebook for Starfleet Battles, and it's the size of a large metropolitan phone book.
True, but hey, I like that phone book. And that's the reason why I like that phone book is all the details that are in there. Now, when FedCom originally came out,
I think I spent so much of my early money buying pieces of it.
Right. The original, you know, when Federation Commander first came out, because I remember that, because I was actually around and paying attention at that point. Many, 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 many years ago, when Ken Burnside was working for ADB, and he actually helped bring that forth. I think he's the one that came up with the idea of the ship cards, which are a fantastic idea. And one thing ADB had to keep on telling people that it's like, hey, this is not SFB Lite. This is its own game, but for the most part, it's SFB Lite. You know, it's simplification of the rules. There's a lot of some things that are different, like one of the things that are different is the way ESGs work. You know, it's not just this globe that was around a ship and you run into things. No, that's not the way it works. Federation Commander is great. I like it in certain respects. In that I agree that it can help the gameplay go a little bit faster. The one thing that they definitely found out the hard way, which was one of their features of FedCom doesn't work. Actually, there's two features.
And that would be?
There's two features that didn't really work out as well as they expected. Number one, the whole idea of squadron versus fleet ships. The whole idea of having fleet ships was to have it so that you could basically play larger fleets in the same amount of time that you can do a smaller fleet. Wrong. And here's the reason why. They've reduced not just the offensive potential, but the defensive potential. So basically, you just shrunk the ships. And in some cases, of course, you shrunk the offensive potential and you had two, if what would be like, it had like three phasers instead of having two phasers, it has one phaser. You know, so it's reduced to less
like the
than 50%.
Cadet phasers from the cadet mm-hmm. module on MacGuard.
Oh, understood.
I mean, the thing is, when you looked at the way what they did for Starfleet Command, they actually went the other direction. In order to scale things up so that they played faster, they gave the ships more destructive power, more defensive power, and more electrical power. It was weird.
Right. Oh,
but it seemed to work.
No.
I see what you're getting at. I think one of the reasons why FC sounds like it's a panacea or even a holy grail, but it's not. And it's got its own quirks. And the thing is that some of the old SFB quirks, like stringing along your volleys after knocking somebody's shield down to buy some of their weapons away, just don't work in FC the same way. And maybe that's a good thing. But like you say, having two different scales on either side of the card, it's got an interesting flavor to it. I have heard of on the board, SBC mentioned the fact that you can usually get away with using the fleet scale cruisers as escorts to pair up with the squadron scale cruisers.
Oh, agreed.
All the same ship.
Oh, agreed. I totally agree with that perspective. And you know, so the BPV also in halves, and so relatively the BPV is correct per se. BPV is a bad number because it's a number that's supposed to cover both offensive and defensive potential against multiple opponents. The idea is that you can actually come up with a number which is very close, to a value. So you can take two ships which are relatively equivalent BPV, and they should be able to fight each other, and it's a relatively even battle kind of thing. It doesn't always work out.
The thing is that even that system has its own flaws. It's one of the discussions threads on the board right now. Is talking about how the alternate timeline for Avians are meat on the table for hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just simple BPV adjustments not going to do anything to fix that. It has to do with the fact that a hybrid fleet will have enough phaser Gatlings to phaser away any volley of quantum wave torpedoes the Paravians send their way. And they just don't have anything else other than phaser boating tactics to fight against the hybrids. Mm-hmm. But that's just one aspect of the way the game system works. And you're right, the BPV is I used to call it the balance factor that one size fits most. Because it usually works.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that if you stress it and you strain it and you look for the edge cases, you will absolutely find it.
Oh, of course.
But also why we have certain vessels that have a high economic BPV but a low combat BPV.
Well, and most of those are scouts. That's the
right.
whole idea.
Because scouts, if you play a scout right, they are extremely valuable to the fleet. The problem is they're also extremely fragile.
Mm-hmm.
You put me in a scout and you put yourself in an equivalent hull type, say you take a lollipop destroyer and I take a lollipop scout. Only thing I'm going to do is turn around and try to figure out the maximum power I can spend to go as fast as possible while throwing myself 12 points of EW. That's about the only way I'm going to survive.
Oh, agreed.
Even then I'm running away.
Right. And that's why, according to, I think, the S8 rules, if I'm quoting it correctly, and that is when it comes to fleet battles, when you're trying to create relatively even fleet battles, where you're using BPV. The one thing that you need to do is with scouts that you don't use the BPV, use the EPV for fleet battles. Now, if it's one-on-one, right. then you use the BPV because of the scouts are great as support
ships. The scouts are under additional restrictions as well, unless there's something like a Galactic Survey Cruiser that has a role where it's operating alone. Most of the time, the scouts are similar to carrier escorts. You can't use them independently.
Right, or even carriers, really. Carriers, a lot of times they remove like the heavy weapons from the carriers.
That's right.
You know.
Well, for starters, particularly with something like a photon or disruptor or fusion-based fighters, the carrier tends to need that power to charge the fighter weapons.
Yep.
It really does slow down the carrier group. Now, the rule I was talking about was that everybody was looking at when they see the, the first of the lollipop destroyer escorts, the DEA, and they see that it's got photons and phaser and two phaser ones and four phaser Gs, or that they centerline you, they can turn around and they can just basically phaser G you into submission.
Right.
Yeah, you can't use those in a duel because the rules won't let you. Excuse me just a moment.
Okay. Right. Sorry, I'm looking at Majestic Games. Universal Skirmish System was put out in 2011. 11 years old. I did buy this one, which was Grand Fleets. It's 6 years old now. Never got to play it, though. Because basically it's, naval combat, which is cool. But anyhow, I like Fight Club. The one thing that I wanted to point out to Jeff, which was also an issue, which I don't think, for most people, don't think it really worked out as well as they had hoped, is the whole idea of the speeding up damage allocation by eliminating the die rolls. Instead of having, okay, so you have 50 internals, you have to roll 50 die. Oh, what a terrible thing. And then you have to individually pick out each one. Because Doug, I'm sure when you were playing Starfleet Battles every day, you had at least the first two columns of the DAC memorized.
Oh, it gets that way after a short while.
Yep. Exactly. So the rolling of the dice and the doing the damage allocation based on what you, but everyone knows about the damage allocation chart, really does not speed things up much in my mind. I really don't feel like that's one of those things that worked out that well that they expected to work out better than it actually did. Did it improve the speed of play? Possibly. Did it eliminate certain things? Yes. It eliminated the whole issue with Mizzy attacks. That form of attack, basically, it eliminated it. Because of now, instead of basically you have that first column where you can get your drone, your phaser, your torp, your phaser, and then second column, which is, you know, after the drone, you hit phaser again. So, and then it's the possibility of basically having small attacks, small internal sets of internals that actually would basically wipe the weapons off the ship. Now, in theory, you can do that because you can, in FedCom, tell it, you know, say that you want to focus on weapons, basically. And that's fine. That just means that, if I remember correctly, it's been a while. If I recall correctly, what that meant was that if you rolled a certain die, instead of choosing one, it would choose another. Because of each track was focused on different things, you know, whether it was focused on weapons or power or things like that. That depends upon what track you actually would roll. And then, of course, with the damage allocation for FedCom, you had the primary damage allocation and then if that one wasn't available, then you drop down, and the lower part, there was an alternate. And if you didn't have the alternate, then you kind of skipped it, and you just said, okay, that one failed. Okay, you go on to the next column. So, with that, you know, it definitely changes the way damage allocation is done, and you know, which is fine. Obviously, there were some real, in my mind, some real good things that FedCom fixed. You know, one of those things that it fixed was, of course, the whole idea of the retrograde. It fixed the retrograde. Why? Because, or how, more point how than why, how it had it so that you would have to spend twice the amount of power to go in reverse than you went if you went forward. So if you want to go backwards, speed 8, it would cost you 16 points of power. I'm assuming movement cost of 1. So, you know, max speed going backwards, you probably would max out somewhere around maybe 24? Maybe max? Probably less than that. You know? So, well, okay. Chris says that the Kaufman retrograde is so silly that he wouldn't want to win a game like that. Well, I understand your perspective, Chris, because of Lord knows it is one of the most unexciting games there is, in my mind, which is you've got this group of ships going backwards and then saying to your opponent, okay, come after me. Where, now, the thing is, another thing that the FedCom did with the Kaufman retrograde, or any retrograde at all, actually, not retrograde, but speed. Speed kills. Now, the one thing, yeah, I know. So that's the thing. Iggy was saying, why would I even engage doing a retrograde? Well, yeah. I can imagine someone who said, oh, I'm gonna retrograde. I'm going to go in reverse. At that point, goodbye. You know, and so, well, you have to attack me because you have to get past me. And it's like, yeah, I do. But this is suicide. You know, I can't beat you. Yes.
I can interject on this. Don't they have to actually go to zero and then accelerate in reverse?
Yeah.
Is that like the one big drawback to attempting that?
Yeah.
Because if I remember correctly, and they actually have to do that first, that gives you some potential for overrunning them, getting behind them, getting around them, keeping them from doing that. some degree. I mean, there are some significant disadvantages to the retrograde. One is that you're, even though you're putting your best shields to your rear, to your enemy, once they're gone, you don't have a lot of ability to, let's say, turn around.
Right.
There's just so many things that are not right with it.
Oh, agreed.
It's only
The rules you're thinking about are quick reverse. And yes, if you don't quick reverse, you have to be at speed zero before you can apply any movement in reverse. You can do what they call a quick reverse, in which case you have to pay a point, a movement cost point, to offset every point of speed you have to ditch in order to go through zero to go in reverse. The thing is, a retrograde is only tactically sound when the enemy has to eliminate you and you're trying to meet up with a force that's going to reinforce you. The falling action, the last stand in space, so to speak. Other than that, it's just a gimmick. Without some structured need for the op four to overrun and blow you away. It's just, yeah, okay, fine. You're going to retrograde that way. Well, we're going to go over here to this other parsec, and we're going to do naughty things to these civilians you're charged with protecting.
Agreed.
No, it just doesn't make sense.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh.
You're right. It's one of those kinds of things that unless there's an overriding reason to do it, you don't do it. And players that try to do it without that overriding reason, yeah, they're looking for the cheese factor. Just like somebody who turns around and drops somebody's shield and spends the next four impulses throwing every individual phaser one at a time on successive impulses in order to grab all those bold headings on the DAC chart.
Right.
One of the guys I used to play with was blind. He had to memorize the DAC chart.
Wow. Well, the interesting thing about the Mitya effect is that that's really a good example of metagaming.
Yeah, it really is. It's min-maxing at a level that was never intended by the designer of the game, and in a fashion that the designer of the game probably didn't foresee, but didn't see a way to fix, short of doing something like you did with FC, where you roll one die and then you apply up to 10 points of damage off that one randomization.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, and like almost anything can be countered too. I mean, if you know that's what your opponent's going for, you just save those extra couple points and do a quick speed change or a turn. So just take away his advantage an instant, and then he has to go on a good shield. That's like, it's interesting because this is an early game from the 70s. That I would say Federation Commander is really the next evolutionary step in it, because I would call SFB more of a huge learning experience that gets condensed. A lot of that gets condensed into the smaller rules of Fed Commander.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my opinion on it.
Oh, I understood.
The outside.
Well, and the one thing that another thing that is the case in Federation Commander that really changes things around versus Starfleet battles, of course, is shield reinforcement. Unlike SFB, if you're going slow, you still basically max out the amount of shield reinforcement you can use based on the number of batteries you have. So if you only have five batteries, you only can put 5 points of power into shield reinforcement for that one shield.
That's a needed change because of the fact that power allocation with Federation Commander did for EA what pre-movement did for plotted movement.
Right.
You don't actually have to set aside in the beginning what you're going to do for specific reinforcement, it just causes no end of trouble. If you just let players go, well, I've got 24 points of power I hadn't used yet, we're just going to brick that alpha strike.
Right.
No, that doesn't work.
Oh, exactly. And again, If at the same time, for Federation Commander, if you are going slow, the idea of you have some extra power available for reinforcement, it's pointless. If someone comes with the big guns coming at you and fires the big guns at you, you will die. You only have so much reinforcement that you actually can put into, and that's based off the number of batteries you have. Has a minor bit of doing the amount of power that you have available. If you can have 20 points of power available, but if you only have 5 batteries, you only can have 5 points of reinforcement. So you're going slow.
That's right.
So it encourages you not to go slow. Because unless there's a specific
reason.
And there's
a lot less things to spend power on, too. I mean, one of the better things about FC, particularly on the energy allocation front, is that every ship picks up almost 4 points of power by ditching housekeeping. You don't pay housekeeping. There's no life support. There's no fire control. There's no shield cost.
Oh, yeah.
It's either on or off. It's binary. It doesn't cost you anything.
Understood. That was one of the things that they – I'm not sure – if they actually adjusted the amount of power that the ships have. My understanding from Steve Cole was that it was automatic. Those things were just automatically done. You know, you no longer had to do it specifically as you had to do with SAB. Now, one thing that FedCom still has, energy allocation. Mainly because of you have multi...
Yes, you have to set your speed and multi-turn arming weapons.
Bingo.
Oh, and shield repairs.
Right, because there are certain things that there still are secret. Your energy allocation is basically secret until you start the turn, because even in FedCom, there's a measure of energy allocation, therefore a measure of planning that goes into the turn at the beginning of the turn. But you know, obviously, unlike SFB, where the EA is everything, there is your plan right there. FedCom, because of all the leftover power can be used however you want to use, assuming you don't have multi-turn armored weapons, it's a really big battery. It makes it more dynamic, and therefore you're not giving away everything when your energy allocation is known at the beginning of the turn.
It's what a buddy of mine used to call the intermediate game. Yeah, you know, once you learn how to do your own EA, you have to learn how to figure out and plot what your enemy's EA is so you know what he's capable of.
Right.
And he said that was the mark of someone who had gotten past their novice stage.
Oh, agreed. Because, basically, the whole idea in that is that, okay, you know how you can do energy. Now, you know what your plan for the turn is. What can your opponent do to counter that plan, and will he do that? Because just because possibly the best thing to counter what you're going to do is this, doesn't mean they will be doing that. They might have their own plan, which then you have to counter. You know, it's
the worst mistake you can make is fall into your enemy's plan.
Oh, I agree. That's why usually you figure out what is your plan for it, but you also have to know how your enemy is going to react to it. And in some cases, think about, okay, what is your enemy going to do, period? What is his plan? You know?
That's it. That's why you have to do it.
Mm-hmm. At that point, then you, after you know, have a good idea of what his plan is, you know, how he'll respond to what your position is, then you can basically get a good guess of what his energy allocation is going to look like and what you can do to respond to that.
Yeah, and since you know how much power his vessel makes, and you can calculate how much he's going to have to spend for the speed plot he's revealing, although mid-turn speed changes make that a pain in the neck, you can turn around and you can figure out, okay, how much does he have left for his heavy weapons? How much does he have left in his phaser capacity?
Right.
How much does he have left for a wild weasel or for a suicide shuttle? Does he have anything after that?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all kinds of little tricks, like one that I wrote up rather poorly for an early term paper that got published with a gaggle and a captain's log of the almost good enoughs of underloading your plasma torpedoes, intentionally downloading your plasma torpedoes in order to throw off your opponent's power tracking of you, so that on the third turn when you turn around and you spend all of your pseudos and you launch a total of 8 F-torps from 4 launchers on a number of impulses right after, real close together, they can't quite figure out what you've done. Did you haste the arm? Did you download? Did you do all these other weird things? And, but, you know, it's like, okay, you've got 8 F-torps flying. You've only got 4 launchers, so we know half of them are fakes. What about the others? What other surprises do you have for us?
Right.
It's just one of those things to rattle an opponent. I don't know of anybody who's ever really used it well, except the guy who talked to me about it. He said it rattled his cage so much that the Romulan ended up knocking him out of the tournament with it. Of course, it was a slightly different set of rules there. He didn't throw 8 plasma Fs because the tournament rules only gave you so many pseudos to use.
Right.
But it's just one of those things. It's like it's that second. You know, when everybody starts, they got that first cadet greenhorn period,
mm-hmm.
and then they get over that and they learn the game a little bit better, and then they hit that ensign greenhorn period where they know the game, they think about the game, but they think too much, they do too much calculation, and they still get whipped and they can't figure out why. That's one of those tricks.
Right.
It doesn't work on anybody that has gotten past that point. Just like a lot of things, you have to turn around and you have to have the experience to build.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why Starfleet Battles is what it is. It's like the players that do it know how much investment it is to get to a point where you can be reasonably competent. Not great, not rated ace, but reasonably competent. And to have a friendly game with someone who has spent that investment is a pleasant source of diversion on an afternoon or evening, and that's why the game survives. It's not like some of these game systems where somebody reads a fact online or watches a Twitch stream or does a little YouTube research and discovers that if you use this tactic with this piece at this time, then they can't beat you. That's not learning the system. That's abusing the system.
Right. Agreed. Obviously the one great thing, and I'm not, was always loved when it comes to tournament play in person, and sometimes online too, when we have the time, which is basically, after the game is all said and done, talking about it, talking to your opponent about, okay, about this and this and this and this, and discovering, okay, where did you make a mistake? And of course, some, you've played long enough, you recognize some of the mistakes that you made, in the game. And of course, in some cases you don't, and your opponent will say, that was a mistake. You could have done something much different. You could have done this. You could have slowed down. You could have turned a little bit earlier, or just kept on coming in, or whatever. But that's being part of a community that really wants
to.
Yes,
it is. It's absolutely there.
Enjoy,
one of my early games, I was in a situation like that, and the guy playing me said, all right, let's call it at this point. Hand me your EA form. I want to show you what you did wrong. And at first, I bowed up like, hey, wait a minute. What is this? And then he showed me, and my mind was blown, and I said, okay, so that's what I screwed up.
Right. You screwed up so badly that you're done. I do this, you're dead. It's like
you have no clue of the gravity of the mistake you've made. You don't know how vulnerable you are by not doing this one simple little thing, which would have completely blocked me cheese tacking you 2 impulses from now when I can get my offside weapons to bear. And you've still got a vacant shield slot aimed at me.
Yeah, and you can't turn.
Something similar.
Because like you're going too fast, so you can't turn. You got to keep on going straight because you can't hit. You just turned this last impulse, so you're screwed.
And the side flip's not going to do it. Yeah, you're stuck. You're stuck with it. You serve the dog's dinner. All you can do now is sit at the table and try to be polite.
Yep. Oh yeah. That is the great thing. You know,
it's like the Wargamers of old who play Advanced Squad Leader. They knew that if they went for the easy cheesy win, they could feel good that afternoon about beating someone who had no clue what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But if they could build them up and treat them right and be respectful about things, then they might have somebody they can play with for the next 20 years.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Sitting down and teaching people to play is like actually one of the most interesting parts about the game altogether. A whole different
Especially when they turn around and they show you things you have never even considered.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but also getting that very beginning, that start. It's something that I've kind of noticed. It's like the difference between, say, a certain collectible card game where people want to go in and to smash the 12-year-old because they want to get their win in, versus other games where the old hand at the game will sit down and teach you how to play. It'll put you up against another opponent that is of a zero skill level, and they'll talk you both through it, or he'll give you like a huge advantage and teach you how the mechanics of the game works.
Absolutely.
I mean, if Paul and I were to sit down to a tournament game, it would definitely be about crushing the other guy. Nine ways to Sunday and the lamentation of the cats later.
The two of you are, I'm assuming, roughly equivalent in tactical skill and experience, at least to a certain degree.
Yes. Yeah.
That makes sense that you bring your A grant, you bring your A game. But the thing is that when you're trying to bring up somebody who is below your perceived level of skill until they either one, con the heck out of you, or two, get better, mm-hmm. you don't turn around and rub their nose in the turf because you want them to come back and do it again later.
Oh, agreed. Now, the one thing is, in tournament play, the one thing is playing against and more or less experienced opponent, things can happen. And I've heard of this happen. This is what I've heard has happened in some cases. Not always, but some cases. Which is, I've seen people play less experienced players and get their butts kicked. Why? Because of they're going against this less experienced player and they're going, oh, they gotta be something. Have something really big, really good playing, really good playing. No, they're just playing really dumb. They don't know what they're doing, and they basically beat them because the more experienced player is waiting for this great reveal, and it's like, no, this guy's playing so dumb, you just don't know how to react to it.
Yeah, or he's playing basic. That's true. You're expecting the ace move, and instead you just get, alpha struck at range 6 instead of range 2.
Right.
And he gets lucky.
Right. And it's like the thing is that used to be part of the handout that the guys would hand out at Origins and all the other really big tournament events. As I said, this is not where you learn to play the game. This is when you already know to play the game. They used to try to screen out the people who didn't really know yet, because it just wastes everybody's time. I ran a tournament in 95, I think it was, and one of the players was scratching their head trying to figure out how the Klingon was doing the things the Klingon was doing, but he didn't know enough to call a judge over and ask questions.
Right.
Because the other guy was polite, and he basically got bullied, and on the next round, somebody else who was experienced enough to go, hey, wait a minute, where are you getting the ability to do this? The guy had run, I think, speed 27 the entire turn up to that point. It got to like impulse 23 or 24, and he dropped four fully overloaded disruptors and a full phaser cap on a centerline alpha.
No, they're not.
The other opponent said, where did you get all this power? And hey, judge, would you come over here and settle this? And we looked at their EA forms, and his was in order. And we looked at the other guys, and we scratched our heads. We did this, that, and the other. And the guy says, well, what was your, talk to us. What was your plan this turn? And he said, oh, God, I know what I did. And he said, oh, what was that? I had a mid-turn speed change. I was supposed to slow way down earlier in the turn. But he had spent 9 points of power twice. So we disqualified him for having his engineering officer on the bridge of the Klingon vessel doing the Klingon power dance. But aside from that, it was just one of those things. The new guy didn't know to ask questions. The experienced guy did. And the thing is that the guy who made the mistake, we're going to be generous and say that it was a mistake and not outright fraud, ruined the day of him, the guy he played in the first round and beat, and the guy who ended up taking advantage of the disqualification in the second round.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those things. You have people that do things one way or the other based on what they perceive is in front of them. If they think meat is on the table, okay. If you're in a tournament setting, just kill them quickly, be polite about it, and then offer to talk to them about it later after the fight's over.
Right.
If you're in a pickup game setting or regular game evening, by all means, get out the kid gloves and teach them a thing or two. It's just you have to apply the right thing at the right time at the right place. Otherwise, you're wasting people's time.
Agreed.
Well, gentlemen, it's been fun, but I'm afraid I'm going to have to sign off.
Yeah, well, I was about to shut
I've
this
got
thing
a few
down.
Things to handle. Well, that's a good place to leave it then.
Yeah. Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's been fun.
Oh, agreed. Great. Thanks for calling in, Jeff.
Sure.
Okay, you have a good night. Well, Doug.
Plug. Pluggity plug, plug. Plug.
Go.
The fundraiser is still open. I talked to the GoFundMe people, and we have until the 24th before I actually have to make a decision or not.
Oh, okay.
So, hey, there's that. I'm still, kind of fencey on it, but I'm looking at probably going with it for running it. And that's basically that. That's just something that happened, the other day I thought I'd let you know about.
Okay.
Other than that, I don't have a lot else to talk about tonight other than thank you for the games that you donated to Gamers a Winner.
No, you're welcome. I'll
probably be putting those out for this week. Sweetie was really happy to see that because of the spread of the games, the depth of them.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that she could put the kids there, all the way up through, hey, old grognard, you, here's Titan. Let's see what you're made of.
Yep.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, even there's even, I think I gave you guys some two cribbage boards. Anyone who knows how to play cribbage, hey, why not? Because actually, that's one thing I learned to play when I was in college. I never had played against anybody, but I learned how to play it. Because when I played at Drex University, I had a group of individuals that played Pinochle. That was awesome. Now, if we could get a group of people to play Pinochle at Gamers of Winter or Summer, I'd sit there easily for 10 hours and play Pinochle.
Oh, yeah. That's something that I would look into the legality side of it, with charging people to come in and play. It's just something that, like, from the earliest days of the convention, I've looked at doing here and there. Like, we've had, Mike can teach you how to play Rook or Cribbage. I could teach you how to play Cribbage. But it's one of those really specialized things that I bet you if I tried, I could probably go find some Cribbage group out there in the area. But when I have looked, it's just so, like, few and far between.
Oh, understood. You know, understood.
There's, like, organized things, like bridge clubs.
Right. Right. Oh.
Talk.
That's what my parents used to play with their friends. They come over and they have two tables set up. So they have, that means they had four couples, and they play bridge the whole night through. So they always had lots of fun. I still remember also many times playing Pinochle with my brothers and my mother and all, because my best friend, he'd come in from out of town, and we'd be start playing at 10 o'clock at night, and we do that until like 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, we just love playing Pinochle together.
So. Yeah, but some of the statutes in Pennsylvania get a little funny about that stuff.
Yeah, well, remember, Pinochle's not...
I haven't had...
Dude, you do realize what Pinochle is.
I mean, it has to do with card games.
Right, it's a card game, but you don't... Games. There's no betting involved.
Like, oh, I know that. You know that. The local district attorney may not know that. It's just... But then again, it's just something I haven't had a huge calling for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever had anybody come in and say... do you guys have a bridge tournament going on in the convention?
Right. Oh,
I know at Origins they actually had some small subsets of card games,
mm-hmm.
but that wasn't really the main focus of that event.
Right.
And that's kind of a similar thing for us. I mean, our main thing is just providing a space for people to do their RPGs and the various board games and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, but we're looking at doing it. Oh, and other weirdness kind of thing. I may be talking to one of the venues that was on the radar but didn't make it for being a venue, because we ended up at the fire hall for so many years.
Right.
So we may get a nice social club, like not the Moose, but a different type of thing.
Right.
There's that. I'll be talking to them in the next few weeks.
Cool.
And, oh, my gosh, if that works out, that would be pretty awesome. That would take care of a 99% of the issue about, you know, getting a space. Although, honestly, I still would prefer, like, thousands of dollars in donations to get, a storefront space for a month or so. Because of just... how much could be done with that space for an event like ours versus just having a space for a couple, 3 days, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But that's just my personal opinion.
Oh, understood.
I'm all for that.
Yeah.
I have not much else there other than if you wanted to go and talk about the F&E thing for another hour.
No. Well, dude, it's quarter of 11 now.
Shut up. Okay, I want to go.
Yeah, because I still got to put this thing together before I go to bed tonight, which means I probably won't be getting to bed till like 11:30, maybe a little bit later than that. So, and I still have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go work. So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, you have a good night.
Have a good one, Paul. Okay,
you too.
Having us on.
Yep. Okay. Bye. So, had a nice little discussion about FedCom and different, you know. Actually, it was a very nice overall discussion about ADB gaming and such. You know, talked a little bit about the F&E and also, you know, FedCom. So I think we had a nice discussion. Nice to have Jeff around. And, of course, Doug has been around as of late. So it's always good to talk to him, too. So with that, I am Paul Franz, and I bid you a good night.